to the EWU seminar today. Professor Lee got his undergraduate degree at the University of Washington and his PhD at Caltech in chemical engineering, after which he launched his academic career initially at Auburn, where he rose through the ranks. He then moved briefly to Purdue and then spent about 10 years at Georgia Tech. Since 2010, he has been back to his native Korea at KAIST, Department of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering there. He actually served as a head of that department previously. He is currently the director of the Saudi Aramco KAIST CO2 Management Center, as well as serves as the associate vice president of KAIST for international office. He's had a number of visiting appointments at places like DuPont, Seoul University, and more recently the Chinese University of Hong Kong. He has mentored an excess of 55 PhD and PhD students and postdoctoral associates, and he has been widely recognized for his contributions. I'm only going to mention a couple of notable awards, like the ACHC CAS Computing in Chemical Engineering Award. This is the premier award of our community that was bestowed to him a few years back. He was recently the Roger Sargent Lecturer. He has been the recipient of an NSF Young Investigator Award, and he has been elected a fellow of many societies such as ACHC, the IFAC, and the IEEE. Over the years, he has had many research interests and contributions in those areas, control, approximate dynamic programming, planning and scheduling, synthesis, design, and operation of energy systems like biorefineries and CO2 capture systems. I don't want to go through the whole list I have here. I understand he's having a big interest also in machine learning and how that can impact process systems engineering, and I believe that is what he's going to cover with us today. So without further ado, Professor Jaylee, thank you for being with us. We look forward to your talk.
Well, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that it's certainly an honor for this webinar. This is probably the first webinar that I'm giving. I also apologize if I start being a little bit incoherent, because it's getting close to my bedtime here in Korea. But, as the title, can everybody see my slide? Okay?
Yes, we can see you here.
Okay. So let me say, first of all, that the topic I'm going to address today is reinforcement learning. So that's a particular kind of machine learning. And we'll talk about what it means for process control as well as other multi-scale decision problems. Now, I do have to acknowledge contributions of Tom Badgerill, who may be in the audience right now, because a lot of slides that I'm going to use, especially the first part of the talk, came from our joint PSC presentation, plenary talk at recent PSC meeting, and I shamelessly stole some of his slides. So, and he said it's okay. That's gracious. All right. Okay, so I have a lot of slides. You'll see if you've got my slide PDF file, you'll see a lot of slides that I'm not gonna use today due to time constraint, but I'm going to talk mainly about two things. First of all, I'm going to give introduction of reinforcement learning and what it means for process control. And then we'll talk about something that may be more interest to this particular audience, which is how to use reinforcement learning by combining it with mathematical programming for multi-scale decision making. All right, so the first part, the agenda looks like this. So mostly we'll talk about what reinforcement learning is and some technical details. And then we'll talk about, reinforcement learning versus model predictive control, or whether they could be used in complementary sense, implications for process control and future research directions. Then we'll move on to the, more general decision problems. Okay, so reinforcement learning is a kind of machine learning that an agent actually learns a decision policy, not just a pattern or categorization, but is learning a decision, the learn to make decision by taking action and observing the response of the environment. So these responses of the environment are usually in the form of reward or penalty. And so it has its roots in animal psychology, carrot and stick, and those kind of animal training ideas. Okay. Sorry. So typically, what he learned is a policy. And what policy means is that given a state, he has to take an action. It's a mapping between current state, S, and the action he has to take, which will maximize a long-term value function, which is given here, where gamma is just a discount. So it is some sort of an economic return, you can say, that is trying to maximize with discounted with, you know, gamma factor. Okay. So this clearly is related to this multi-stage decision-making and Bellman's optimality equation, which is shown here, right? So this so-called optimal value function has to satisfy the following relationship. And when this relationship is satisfied, this value function V star of S is maximized. So essentially what we have to do to solve this problem is that we have to solve this Bellman optimality equation. And this is usually done through dynamic programming, and that's why reinforcement learning has close relationship or connection with dynamic programming. Now, Bellman's optimality equation is very difficult to solve, especially for practical problems. The reasons are many, but first of all, usually we don't know the environment model. This is the lack of model, that we don't have the transition, state transition equation. And the second is that even if we did, the solution complexity goes with state dimension. This is so-called the curse of dimensionality. And if you look at this function V that we have to solve for, that's a function of state, which means that the solution we are looking for may be infinite dimensional. So reinforcement learning can be regarded as trying to get approximate solution to Bellman's optimality equation, dealing in various ways with these two limitations. Okay? Now, I'd like to, turn your attention to this particular statement by one of the pioneers of computer science, modern computer science, Alan Turing. I'm sure you know him. That he said this in 1950, that instead of trying to produce a program to simulate the adult mind, why not rather try to produce one which simulates the child? If this were then subjected to an appropriate course of education, one would then obtain the adult brain. And we normally associate punishment and rewards with the teaching process, and so on and so on. So this distinguishes reinforcement learning from another AI technique called expert system. Expert system is trying to produce adult mind. Reinforcement learning starts from scratch, from a child's mind, and then subjects it to an appropriate course of education so that it can learn its smart decision-making. So that is why expert system, you need a lot of prior expert knowledge, prior domain knowledge, as opposed to reinforcement learning. You don't need any knowledge in principle. You can learn from available data. And the reason why reinforcement learning has come to the limelight, I think there are three reasons. So this vision, you know, in 1950 has become somewhat of a reality these days. And this is due to powerful new reinforcement learning algorithms that came along, as well as the recent developments of deep neural networks, which provided good function approximation for very complex functions. as well as powerful new hardware like the GPUs, computing, and so on. Now, of course, the public's attention on reinforcement learning really exploded with this Google DeepMind AlphaGo, which beat the world-class players. Okay, and this was considered significant because the game of Go was considered to be unreachable by artificial intelligence because of the combinatorial complexity. So if you look at this slide here, this is how many possible combinations you have, 10 to the 360. So each move, there are generally about 250 possible moves one can make, and then you have about 150 tons. So combinatorially, you have number of branches, which easily exceeds the number of atoms in the universe. So really, the breadth, which is 250, as well as depth, 150, are the main reasons for this computational explosion. So what we have to do to make this feasible in terms of computation is that we have to reduce the search space by breadth reduction and depth reduction. And it has reduced the breadth by building this powerless network, which has kind of idea about good legal moves for a particular state. So it has this probability distribution. You know, it doesn't fix a move, but it has a number of possible moves, and then it gives a probability distribution so that good moves will have higher probability to be picked. And the depth reduction, it builds value network. So even a particular old position, it tells you what the probability of my winning, which means that I don't have to look until the end of the game. I can kind of quit in the middle after some moves and then use this value network to figure out how good a state I will be reaching in a few moves. So that's how we achieve this best breadth reduction and depth reduction to make this computer-based Go playing feasible. And this is shown here, the way they did it. They started out with published human expert positions, and then they did classification, essentially supervised learning, to came up with policy network. And then once they had policy network, they did the self-play, and as many as 30 million games per day were played with each other. And then it evolved. And based on this self-play data and regression, it built value networks. Okay? And that's how it beat the world-class player. You know, a human player, will probably end up, if they are, you know, professional players, they'll end up playing not more than 1,000 games. Maybe 3,000 games or something. He's playing 30 million games per day. So, you know, it's really using enormous amount of data. And then it has evolved. So the latest version, AlphaGo Zero, really circumvents this human expert position learning. And they say that this is much better. And so, you know, I was wondering about this fact because how is it possible that it's not using prior knowledge, but it actually does better than the case where, you know, it learns from human experts. So the prior knowledge actually made it worse this time. I think it's because when you start out with human expert positions, you tend to bias the search. So you produce computer program that plays like humans, so to speak. But excluding this human expert data, that it has really unbiased exploration. And now you have AlphaGo, which plays nothing like humans. Okay? And actually, human players are now learning from AlphaGo how to play the game. Anyway, this is interesting. I go back to my presentation at CPC in 2006. I was talking about this chess playing. And I had you know, kind of the same idea that you start out with expert players playing large amount of games initially to come up with initial policy. And then I talk about self-play, build value function approximation. So I think it's a pure coincidence that, you know, we seem to have the same idea. Okay, you know, just to give you some details about reinforcement learning, there are basically three classes of algorithms for reinforcement learning. One learns the value function. And by learning this optimal value function, then the optimal policy is implicitly defined, because what you can do is you can just do simple single-step greedy policy to get the optimal policy. So it only learns the value function, and it typically does this through what's called true learning or temporal difference learning. Okay, so it kind of iteratively updates this value function as it simulates, continually using the current approximation, and then updates the parameters of this value function. And then there's what's called dual heuristic programming, which learns, instead of the value function itself, the gradient of the value function with respect to the state, because that's actually what's used in the optimization. And the trouble with learning value function may be that you end up with the over-parameterized system, which has very poor gradient information. So this particular technique learns the gradient directly. And then, as opposed to the learning value function, you can also search for the optimal policy directly. Okay, optimal policy directly. And this typically is done through so-called policy gradient algorithm. So you parameterize the optimal algorithm, and then you use like gradient search and then try to converge to the optimal policy. Now, active critique algorithm, which may be the most famous algorithm of reinforcement learning, does both. So AlphaGo, that I, as I introduced, has policy network and value network, and therefore it's an active critique algorithm. So it has policy, which suggests good moves, then it has value network, which will tell you the long-term performance. Now, let me talk about some issues in reinforcement learning, which is that, first of all, what do we compute for estimation targets? So if you look at it here, there's the temporal difference learning, which only does very shallow tree search. Why? Because it only has to look up to one step ahead in updating the value function, because it uses the previous value approximation. So it has a very shallow backup. You know, it keeps using its own approximation continually, and it doesn't have to go in depth. As opposed to Monte Carlo search method, which AlphaGo has used, you look at many, many steps into, maybe not until the end, but many steps, and you construct all these trees using the current policy network, and then it evaluates the value from the simulation directly. Okay? So it has a deep backup. And, you know, both have pros and cons. Shallow backups, you know, computation will be faster, variance will be low because you don't have as many parameters, but, you know, some bias will be there, as opposed to deep backups, you know, you tend to require much more samples, many more samples, much more computation, but bias would be less. And then the TD lambda learning is something that combines both. Okay, so let me just leave it at that. And then there's the issue of value function approximation, and what do you want to use as the function approximator? So the most famous one is the artificial neural networks, obviously, you know, And deep learning, especially, has made the headlines. So, you know, deep neural networks are popular choice for doing this function approximation for the value network and policy network. But you can use other function approximators, clearly. I mean, if you know features, if you can construct features, key features of the state, then you can do linear combination. For example, in a lot of these economic optimization problems, it's known that value function is approximately piecewise linear with respect to the state, which are typically inventory levels and so on. So you may not need something as complex as deep networks in that case. Or you can use other non-parametric models like Gaussian process, kernel regression, or k-nearest neighbors, which have some nice convergence properties and so on and so on. So there are many choices for approximating these complex functions. Now, another issue that you deal with in reinforcement learning is exploration versus exploitation versus exploration, okay? So this is a fundamental issue that exists in any data-based decision-making. So exploit means that you use the current knowledge that you have to calculate the best action, essentially greedy action, which will optimize your reward function. Explore means that you try to take an action which will reveal information about the uncertain parameters and so on. Okay? So here, you can see that average-wise, red is the best in terms of profit, but you can see that in terms of the upper potential, blue has a lot of upper potential. So you can try to explore by generating an action which will tell you about the blue and reduce the variance, and it may turn out that indeed red is better, or it may turn out that the blue is better. So exploration can pay off in terms of the future rewards. Now, how do you actually explore? There are many, many different ways of doing this, starting from naive exploration, where you will just add random noise to the policy. So essentially, you do exploitation, but with some randomness, or something very systematic, like constructing belief states, which are essentially states that tell you about the parameters of the probability distributions of the unknowns. And there are many algorithms like Gideon's indices and knowledge gradient and so on that you can use. Okay? But the formal way of doing this really is in the context of what they call Markov decision process is Bayesian inference. Okay, so you have prior knowledge, then you have data, and then you end up getting posterior distribution and a posteriori estimate. And by using this Bayesian inference, you can try to optimize your actions, which will, essentially give you the best long-term reward. And for the long-term reward, you may actually have to explore rather than exploit. And, one example is dual optimal control that's adaptive control that you really have to excite the process artificially to know about how the parameters behave. Now, another issue that you have with reinforcement learning is that you can go with stochastic policy versus deterministic policy. So deterministic policy looks like this. For given state, you have particular action that you will take. Stochastic policy, for given say, you don't have particular action, you have probability distribution of actions. So why do you want the random kind of policy? Well, sometimes that's what you need. For example, this rock, paper, scissor games in game setting, if you take a deterministic policy, it may be easily exploited by the opponent. And the So, for example, in this game, the uniform random policy turns out to be the optimal policy. Or here, you have this example of Elias grid world, okay, where the agent cannot differentiate between the gray boxes and gray states. So you get into this situation where the current trained policy looks like this, and you may just get stuck here. Yeah, you can see here by introducing randomness, with some probability, you'll go here and you go. Okay, so this stochastic policy, can take on different forms, but at the end of the day, given state, you are defining the probability distribution in the action space. Now, let me show you this example of bipedal robot. This is an example that's actually done at ExxonMobil by Tom Badger's group. And this is this example is kind of benchmark problem for testing different kinds of control algorithms. It's implemented in the so-called OpenAI gym. And it's got 24 continuous states, all these angle speed, angular velocity, and so on and so on, as well as 10 rangefinder measurements to kind of look, you know, in front of the walking direction and giving you information about the hills and obstacles and so on and so on. And there are four continuous actions, which are leg joint torques. And then you set up this penalty function. So every time it moves forward, you give some positive reward, but you apply some penalty when it falls down, 100 feet penalty when it falls down, and apply some penalty for using leg motor torque. So if you look at it, after 3,000 episodes of training, it does this. So it's very crudely walking. And then after a lot more training, that is able to now walk pretty well. And then even more training will give some surprising results, that it's walking on one leg. The reason for that is that the optimization function actually analyzes leg motor torque. By using only one leg, that is able to save this penalty on leg motor torque, which kind of underscores the importance of choosing the right objective function, because if you don't do that, then you may end up getting some surprises like this. And then if you train more, you can go through all these obstacles and hazards and so on and so on, and it's doing a very good job. So it's working, obviously, quite well, but after a lot of training. Okay, so what does it mean in terms of process control? So, you know, the current state of the art for process control really is model predictive control. So, you know, comparing reinforcement learning with MPC, the so-called advantage is that there is no need to develop process model. But modeling is kind of implicit in the way that you learn this policy. So it's not like it doesn't need a model, but it learns from the data, and it learns it implicitly through learning this optimal policy. It's able to work with complex nonlinear stochastic environments and can potentially yield optimal policy. Now, model predictive control in stochastic environments do not give you optimal policy. You know, it's done in deterministic prediction setting, and it's not capable of producing optimal policy for stochastic systems. Fast online execution, because if you have a policy already, or value network, or value function, which can easily be used in optimization. But you need a lot of offline training. Can adapt to changing environments. But, you know, you need extensive trial and error learning for this. So it may be possible in simulation, but in real operation environment, this may not be feasible. Must be allowed to fail during training, which is certainly not possible in the context of chemical operation. Training may not be stable or repeatable. This happens quite a few times when you train and train again. You know, you don't get the same results every time. You may get stuck in local minima during training, and extensive goal engineering may be required. And if a goal changes, of course, you have to train again. As opposed to in model predictive control, you just have to state the objective function differently. And no formal closed-loop stability and so on. Okay, so you don't think that reinforcement learning can replace existing process controllers like model predictive controllers. It's you know, it's got its characteristics that are very well suited to the way chemical processes are operated. Also, reinforcement learning agents can help manage process control systems. Somebody doing that. Okay. So reinforcement learning agents advise operators during unusual situations, so abnormal situation management, fault detection diagnosis, all those are, I think, fair games. And hierarchical management of chemical operation, safety agents, environmental compliance, reliability, economic optimization, all these agents, multi-agents can hierarchically train to do the, you know, things that current controllers cannot do very well. And finally, future research direction. I think for chemical processes, benefit from reinforcement learning, you need to develop so-called disciplined learning, you know, not just a lot of training and failures, learning from failures and so on, but much more discipline. Something, start with something good already and then improving upon this. Integrating reinforcement learning with MPC, and some previous work have indicated this, exploration versus exploitation. And then some theoretical results like the convergence and closed-loop stability, and also parallelization of this training of recursive or the reinforcement learning algorithm when you have uncertainties. Okay. So just to show you the potential of reinforcement learning versus model predictive controllers, I show you this example. This was published 2009. And this is a reactor and separator and recycle loop here. And it's got a lot of states, as you can see here. It's got more than 40 states. It's trying to control the bottom composition, bottom product composition, as well as some manipulated input from the set point deviation and so on. And it's got 6 different manipulated inputs. And one thing that I did here is subjected it to stochastic disturbances in terms of the kinetic parameters as well as the feed composition. And what we did is we designed nonlinear model predictive controllers with different tunings. And different tunings will work well under different situations. And that is why we designed 7 different of them. Some of them are aggressive. Some of them are not aggressive. Some of them are for particular regions and so on. And we start with these 7 nonlinear predictive controllers and then do the training from the closed-loop data and construct these reinforcement learning controllers. And then we end up with a controller that works much, much better than any of these nonlinear model predictive controllers, which were used to generate the data for reinforcement learning. They can actually begin with something that currently is in operation, and then collect the data online and continually improve the performance. Okay. Now, since the time is constrained, let's move on to something that may be of wider interest to this audience, which is combining reinforcement learning with mathematical programming for dynamic decision making. Okay, so you got the decision maker and uncertain environment, and then we have the sequential decision making where decision is made and executed on uncertain environment, and then we can actually observe the state response, and that information can be used to make the subsequent decisions. Okay, and such problems are very ubiquitous in many, many domains, industrial manufacturing, financial engineering, robotics, so on and so on, certainly game playing as well. So is it possible to iteratively improve this decision maker using reinforcement learning? Okay, so what is the current state? You got this popular pyramid here showing the operation hierarchy of process industry. And the interest here is really integrating planning and scheduling, because a lot of times what happens is when you want to integrate scheduling with planning at the detail of scheduling level, then you end up with something that's too large, right? So you tend to aggregate the model or develop surrogate model and use simpler model in the upper level planning, which will lead to optimistic estimates and eventually lead to infeasible plans for various reasons. Okay, so that's the reason why you want to integrate between planning and scheduling. So let me give you this renewable energy example where, you know, you got planning like yearly planning of capacity planning, as well as daily planning, where you have to commit certain types of energy generation, and then you got hourly dispatching schedule. And of course, when you have renewable wind energy, like, you have very, very fast changing uncertainty. And if you average them out, you're going to get very optimistic estimation, right? So if you try to coarse grain, then you get something that's not very good estimate of the true performance. If you formulate this at fine scale, so you want to formulate everything in hourly scale, then you end up with 24 hours times 365 days, you end up getting 8760 hours, and even 1 year window, it may be computationally infeasible. You may actually have to look into several decades to proper capacity planning. So in terms of handling this, you can take the mathematical programming route and do the stochastic programming with recourse that everybody should be familiar with here. And so you can construct a scenario tree and then do optimization to construct to obtain decision tree. The solution is given in terms of decision tree. Or you can formulate it as Markov decision process, a lot like the state space model. And then, you know, you can solve this using dynamic programming or reinforcement learning to get the value function, which is expected sum of all future costs. So the data is given in terms of probability distribution, and the solution will be in terms of decision policy, that given state, what action you should be taking. Now, when I look at this planning problem versus scheduling problem, they have some characteristics. Like high-level management planning, you have fairly well-known states like inventories and prices and so on, and they follow fairly simple dynamics. But a lot of uncertainties are involved because, you know, you have market uncertainty and so on and so on, evolving over a long time, and you really need long time horizon decision-making. On the other hand, at the scheduling level, you have very complex dynamics and constraints, lower uncertainty, I would say, because, you know, you have frequent feedback that you can actually take care of, and then you need a need for resolving this so-called end effect that you should be familiar with. So from these characteristics, what we can say is that high-level planning problems are better suited for Markov decision process formulation and dynamic programming or reinforcement learning, and low-level scheduling problems are more suited to mathematical programming like LTs and MILTs and so on. So how do we integrate this? Well, what we can do is we can actually optimize with mathematical programming. So we can embed this mathematical programming into the low level and simulate. Those will be LPs or MILPs, which can be easily simulated. And then this will provide data samples for state transition and reward, which can be used in reinforcement learning at the higher level. And from the reinforcement learning, you have this value function, which will provide long-term evaluation therefore you can resolve some of the difficulties with NDSAT. And of course, to do that, you need this multi-scale uncertainty model, that's consistent across time scales. So weather factors, market factors, you will need big data. And the challenge here is that these trends tend to be non-stationary, will have deterministic components as well as stochastic components, and will have periodicity like the diurnal or daily or seasonal and so on. Okay, so we have done this and on a number of applications, and there, some of those are shown here, microgrid operation and design, and the reference is given here. We also did it for refinery procurement and production planning, where we are trying to select from available crude types and try to produce the products that we want with the selected crude. And then we have raw material procurement and planning, where we have multiple raw material suppliers with different prices and reliability and so on, delivery dates and so on, and we can we are trying to optimize the cost of raw materials, but subject to meeting certain demands. Now, we don't have time to address all these. You can certainly look at the papers to get the detail. But for this presentation, I've decided to take you through this particular application of microgrid with multi-scale wind uncertainty. Okay, so the problem we have is that we have a power system that's connected to national grid. So you can sell and buy electricity. It's got wind turbines as well as the conventional generators, and it can store energy, and it has to meet certain demand. Okay? And the kinds of problems we look at are dispatch, unit commitment, and design and sizing, which have different time scales. So in terms of dispatch, we have to decide the output of online sources, minimize operating costs while meeting the hourly load. So, you know, whether to store energy or discharge stored energy or produce energy and so on. And then we got a unit commitment. So some generators you have to commit one day early to be able to use. And they will cost, okay? And then finally, this capacity planning, where you have size the capacity of the wind. And all these are multi-scale because you have hourly uncertainty dynamics, which affect the upper level, and you got daily seasonal uncertainty and so on. So what we have done is we have done the modeling. We took this wind power conversion model, which tells you between wind speed and power generated, battery dynamics, which have charging, discharging, as well as self-discharging, fairly simple model. We have two types of generators, slow start generators, where you have to have commitment one day ahead, and you have fast start generators, which have more flexible kind of availability, but they tend to be much more expensive. And then the electricity demand tends to take this kind of shape with some variation. Okay, so you got this generation dispatch problem, hourly, unit commitment, daily decision, and sizing, which is yearly decision, and lots of variations. Uncertainties are mainly the wind speed, intraday variation, seasonal variations, and so on. So what we have done is we have constructed such consistent multi-scale stochastic model that we've expressed the average, daily average of the wind speed or through this first-order Markov chain, and that goes into this hourly model. You know, so daily average value is taken from this model here. And then you also have daily hour profile, deterministic profile, as well as effects of previous hours, because they tend to have time correlations and the random noise. And then you have to do parameter estimation, which will produce a model which tells you about the intraday wind transition as well as intraday wind transitions. And then we tested this with actual data from the National Wind Technology Center, 2002 to 2014. We didn't use the data from 2011 because that was an unusual year due to El Nino. Okay? And then we took the intraday and looked at the how good the generated model is, and they seem to follow very the patterns of actual data quite well. And so once we have this kind of multi-scale, scale-wise consistent stochastic model, that now we can actually use this model to do this combined mathematical programming and reinforcement learning. And, of course, we have to kind of assess the performance, so we decided to compare against this two-stage stochastic programming, where the first stage decision, here and now decision, is the unit commitment decision, and the recourse decision, or second stage decision, is the dispatch decision. So, but the trouble is the two-stage stochastic program can only treat one day. It cannot handle the multi-day problem. Then you need a lot more stages. And so you could suffer from this end effect where it will try to run out the battery level at the end because there's no use of saving this battery. Okay, or we can take the proposed approach where we got mathematical programming, LP, which will optimize this dispatch, generation dispatch decision, and then reinforcement learning, which will do the unit commitment decisions, and then we can take this value function and actually use it in sizing as well. And then we have the multi-scale wind uncertainty model. Okay, so we tested this. We used the data from 2002 to 2014, as I said, to construct the wind uncertainty model. And 2015 wind data, which was not used for modeling, is used for comparing the performance of the two methods. And these are some of the system parameters. We got three slow generators, one fast generator, battery, as well as HVDC, which can be used to buy and sell from the national network. Okay, so we've done the simulation throughout the year, and here's one particular kind of simulation result where looks like on one of the days, 15th day of a month, that if you compare the two-stage stochastic programming with this integrated master decision process LP model, that we do slightly worse with method two. Okay? But it's running out this battery level here, and that really hurts at the 16th day, that it has to now actually use much more expensive generator here to satisfy the demand. And that translates into 7.1% improvement in terms of the overall cost. So you sacrifice a little bit so that you will do much better the next day. So therefore, you are considering this long-term performance. Now, we have tested it for all 365 days, and improvements were noticed for 151 out of 365 days. The rest of the days, it didn't make any difference. And in particular, January, February, September, October, November, December, these were the months that showed marked improvement by using this new method. The reason for that is wind variability is much larger during winter months than the summer months. Okay, therefore, when the wind variability it becomes severe, that the method they can rigorously take into account this wind variation, wind uncertainty, you get a lot more benefits. Okay, so that just about wraps up our promised 50 minutes. I'm slightly over time. I'm sorry about that. Let me just summarize. Reinforcement learning has its technical roots in animal psychology and optimal control. Optimal control, you know, and it goes back to dynamic programming and so on. And recent advances like deep neural network, new reinforcement learning algorithms and GPU hardware and so on really has resulted in some remarkable performance in certain applications. Now, it's got advantages and disadvantages relative to model CPQ control, in my opinion. And I think it's important to find a combination where, you know, the two technology can be combined in a very complementary manner. And that's kind of begun, but only at very beginning stage. So there's a lot more research that could be done, which will combine the two technologies into something that really can do much more than, you know, standalone can. I think extensive offline learning is possible if a good simulator is available. Otherwise, for online learning, you know, it's important to develop this discipline learning approach. And the potential applications include the management of control systems, something that sits above control systems to manage, as well as kind of abnormal situation management, hierarchical management of plan operation. And finally, I kind of focus your attention on using reinforcement learning to integrate strategic business decisions with plan operation decisions. I'd like to close by saying that reinforcement learning has the potential to significantly impact both the theory and practice of process control, as well as process systems engineering, especially in integrated strategic operational decision making. And finally, let me acknowledge the contributions of Tom Bedwell, who, as I said, worked with me on this PSE presentation. Matthew Rial, my longtime colleague at Georgia Tech, who contributed the ideas of machine learning, and the PhD student, Juhyun Shin, who will have defense next month. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for a very interesting...
Here are some references, by the way, for you to look at.
Excellent. Thank you so much for a very interesting presentation. Let me begin by people who may have been joining over the phone. Is there anybody out there who has a question for our speaker?
Yes. Hello, Professor Lee. This is Jinendra from ABB. You talked about disciplined learning in the example of distillation column as well as towards the conclusion. What is this disciplined learning for online learning?
Yeah, so in typical reinforcement learning, what you do is you start from nothing, okay? And you use a lot of random actions in the beginning to initiate. And that will lead to all sorts of failures and you know, in real operation, variability and so on. And that has gone for very, very long time, which is certainly not suitable for chemical plan operation, right? You don't want to kind of randomly move the chemical process for, you know, several years or something just to learn this control policy. So disciplined learning means is that you have to do the learning in a very disciplined way, which will minimize the data required and also not disrupt the ongoing online operation. That is why I suggested that you start out with controller that's already in place in closed loop. And then you generate this closed loop data, you know, either through the natural disturbances or some probing, okay, and then improve that controller through reinforcement learning and come up with the next version of controller, which will be an improved version of the current controller. And you can just keep doing that, okay? So you can do, like, step-by-step evolutionary improvement of control systems. So that's, I think, what I mean by this.
Thank you.
It means is that you shouldn't expect to use a lot of data that are generated in very random fashion.
Understood. Professor Lee, one supplement question in that is, you know, for reinforcement learning, you need a lot of excitation or a lot of, you know, variety in the data. And on the other side, we are restricting to have disciplined data. Isn't that a counter to the very fundamentals of reinforcement learning, because it expects variety of data?
In some sense, I would say yes, but you know, the idea would be that first of all, you know, if you got a simulator, right? If you got a model, or if you, you know, not even just a very explicit model, but something that you can simulate the behavior of your process or the system of interest, you can do whatever you want. You can do training, random training, and so reinforcement learning could be used that way. Second, if that's not possible and you have to do this online, then the best you can do is take some ideas from reinforcement learning and you know, try to do better than what you can right now. And that's what I'm talking about. That, you know, maybe you are going away from reinforcement learning a little bit, but still some of the ideas in reinforcement learning can be used to improve control systems in closed loop. Because even
model
controllers have their limitations.
Right.
Maybe one more quick question. I know we're kind of running out over time now. Anybody on the phone?
Yeah, by the way, this is Ignacio. By the way, Jane, thanks a lot for a very nice, interesting talk. Can you all hear me, by the way?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so just a very quick question. Your idea of integrating planning and scheduling is to put reinforcement learning at the top, so to speak, planning and scheduling for the math programming. I would think, quite frankly, that maybe the opposite might make more sense in the following, in that reinforcement learning, you're making use of a lot of data, and I would think that if it's at the lower level, that's where it may have a role, because whereas I think usually in planning, you're looking at, as you indicated, longer term, and usually the availability of data is much more iffy. You don't have as much data when you look long term. So can you comment very briefly about planning and scheduling and why you suggest to put reinforcement learning at planning and not at the lower level of scheduling or control?
Okay. First of all, I think it would be very difficult to use reinforcement learning in the context of scheduling or lower level because the number of states will be huge. The state space will be huge. And the second of all, I think the number of constraints that are imposed will be very large, which will be somewhat difficult to account for in reinforcement learning. Now, the reason why planning, I think, would be a good candidate, I thought would be a good candidate, and I'd like to, of course, have further discussion with you on this one, that for planning problems, the number of states can be relatively controlled. They are like inventory levels or information state, like price state and so on, right? And they tend to have more stochastic behavior, which is difficult to account for in the context of mathematical programming, because you know you have to do this stochastic programming with decision trees and so on.
Right. So okay, we'll believe it at that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're running out of time.
We can,
thank you.
Yeah, that's a very interesting conversation, actually, about planning and scheduling. We can all follow it up over ACAT, I guess, shortly. So, Professor Lee, thank you so much for becoming available. It was extremely interesting. Once again, thank you. It was a very nice talk.
Okay. Thank you very much.